Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
The Critical Care PRN is dedicated to fostering the role of critical care pharmacists as essential members of the multidisciplinary patient care team. The Critical Care PRN's goal is to optimize drug therapy outcomes by promoting excellence and innovation in clinical pharmacy practice, research, and education. For more information, including how to become a member, go to critprn.accp.com. Again, that website is critprn.accp.com. Welcome to Pharmacy to Dose, the Critical Care Podcast, a partner of the ACCP Critical Care PRN and a member of the Pharmacy Podcast Network. And I'm your host, Nick Peters. And wherever you are and however you are listening, thank you. I'm very lucky to be a partner with the ACCP Critical Care PRN. I'm excited for all that the partnership will offer. June 1st, the partnership became official. I'm excited for the opportunities to collaborate, I think highlight the awesome things the PRN is doing, and ultimately work together to advance the work of critical care pharmacists, right? So be on the lookout, exciting things on the horizon. So that's great. 2023 Pharmacy to Dose Awards, right? Nominations are open. Be thinking, right? Doesn't get any easier. 9 categories, no CVs. You don't need 8 references and title belts as trophies, right? Link in the episode description to submit a nomination. They close June 23rd. What are you waiting for? Nominate today. Now, this is part 2 of a 2-part series on perioperative emergencies, and I am so lucky to be joined by 4 leaders in the perioperative pharmacy space: Sarah Hyland, Eric Johnson, Gaurang Patel, and Rachel Wolf. So if you haven't yet, be sure to listen to part 1. Right, a great overview on their experience in this space, as well as discussing the management of cardiac arrests in the OR and some evidence-based uses and review of Sigamidex. So part 2 leads off with discussion on LAST, or local anesthetic systemic toxicity, then shifts to reviewing dantrolene and clinical pearls to keep in mind when administering this medication for the treatment of malignant hyperthermia. And then the episode closes with a roundtable discussion with advice and a look into the future of perioperative clinical pharmacy. So part 2, perioperative emergencies, starting right now. So in case we forgot who is on the panel, right here with 4 clinical pharmacists who are well-known, well-researched, and just all around awesome in the perioperative pharmacy space. So this is just a brief intro, right? Part 1, each guest goes a little bit more into their role and background. So Sarah Hyland is a perioperative and emergency medicine clinical pharmacist at Ohio Health Grant Medical Center in Columbus, Ohio, and she's on Twitter at Sarah J. PharmD. Now, Eric Johnson is the perioperative critical care pharmacist at UK Healthcare in Lexington, Kentucky, and you can find him on Twitter at GoBig303. Gaurang Patel is the Director of Clinical Pharmacy Services at the University of Chicago Medicine in Chicago, Illinois. And Rachel Wolf is the Perioperative Clinical Pharmacy Specialist Supervisor at Barnes Jewish Hospital in St. Louis, Missouri. And you can find her on Twitter at Rachel C. Wolf, Wolf with an E at the end. So thanks so much to all four panelists for joining me today, and excited to lead off the discussion with some insight into the management of local anesthetic systemic toxicity, or LAST. And we'll talk about something, right, LAST, that you all hit on, right, that's kind of that unique thing that you might see in the OR that could be contributing to that cardiac arrest. Now, LAST, or local anesthetic systemic toxicity. Now, Rachel, anecdotally or based on any literature that might be out there, are we seeing an increased rate of LAST?
Yeah, Nick, I think we really are. Anecdotally, at least at our institution, we are seeming to hear a lot more about these events. I think in retrospect, I feel it's a little bit related to perhaps expanded use of regional anesthesia techniques, as we're all trying to strive for multimodal analgesia, block different nerves to provide pain relief for our patients. Most often that is now done under ultrasound guidance, but that's a caveat of safety, to where our anesthesia clinicians are more, aware of where they're actually injecting that local anesthetic and decreasing the direct intravascular accidental administration. But then I think possibly maybe even more so a culprit of our increased LAST at our institution is related to our low-dose lidocaine infusions for pain that are frequently utilized both in and outside of the OR space, and possibly even more outside of the OR space and even in the ED and our primarily ED and ICU patients. And that's mostly related to that we end up treating really, really sick patients that may not be clearing the drug as quickly as we intend they would if they were to be a healthy individual. And then also that I think we do push the envelope related to the duration of the therapy itself. So typically we really wouldn't want the infusion to continue longer than 24, 36 hours, but that consistently we do push that out as our patients still have significant pain. And sometimes we try to reduce the amount of opioids that we rely on utilizing. So we do oftentimes use lidocaine for those particular patients. So we certainly have seen a lot more incidences recently. And then the other thing could just be maybe we're also, by being involved, we're hearing about those events even more so when they occur. So they're being reported more frequently when perioperative pharmacists are involved.
That's a really great point. It's kind of like the medication error aspect, right? If you're not there, you don't know about it. It's hard to say if it's an increase or are you just seeing it more. So that's a really good point. Now, when we think of LAST, right, there's a local anesthetic dose. And the concept is if you cross that threshold, right, your risk for experiencing this greatly increases. So, Sarah, for some of the most common local anesthetics, things that people might be familiar with, what are some of those doses that people could kind of keep in the back of their minds?
Yeah, this is an important question because I think the ideal situation is, you know, the clinical pharmacist is consulted on the front end with the anesthesia and our surgical providers as appropriate to help mitigate LAST from happening in the first place, right? Especially as Rachel pointed out, as we start to use all of these different agents from different angles, maybe different providers, different routes of administration, and the cumulative risk starts to really compound. The challenging part here is we really don't know what the safe maximum dose is. There's zero randomized controlled trials here. The guidelines and advisories available to us are literally based on case series and animal studies. So answering this question succinctly is pretty impossible, but I'm going to offer a framework to the audience that I think will do a reasonably good job at mitigating what we can. First of all, ASRA, the American Society for Regional Anesthesia, maintains guidelines on this topic. They were last updated in 2017, and they have a comprehensive checklist of just best practices. Work with your anesthesia team. Make sure we follow best practices. It's easier said than done, but there are guidelines out there that may not be being followed, at least consistently. They also have a checklist that they updated in 2020 that is this nice, simplified, color-coded flow sheet. For responding to a LAST event. Have that handy. when it comes to making this assessment on the front end and not exceeding these, you know, quote unquote maximum doses, we would basically need a study for every drug for every type of injection. So every block is different. There are patient specific factors, block specific factors, and medication specific factors that can all change from patient to patient to increase this risk. So the numbers I'm going to provide here are come with an infinite list of cautions and caveats, but the big numbers I remember are 5, 2, and 3. So for lidocaine, 5 mg/kg, bupivacaine, 2 mg/kg, ropivacaine, 3 mg/kg. The process that the framework that I kind of personally have adopted, which again is based on my interpretation of the data that we do have, which is not very good, but it's all we have. As you know, first tally up all of the proposed drugs and doses that the patient is going to potentially be exposed to. So usually this comes in some type of form of the anesthesiologist wants to do a block with this much volume of ropivacaine, and the surgeon wants to also instill some local anesthetic into the surgical site additionally. So you might have different drugs, different providers, different types of injections. We need to account for all of that. And then you want to calculate a kind of maximum dose for that patient using their ideal body weight is another important concept here. Then also kind of maybe take that factor down by 10 to 20% has been suggested in the literature for patients who are at an increased risk for last. And we have table number 6 and table number 7 in the publication that really help simplify, you know, what these risk factors are that we're looking for, what these doses are. And once we kind of, you know, look at all the drugs, look at the patient, calculate a max dose based on ideal body weight, adjust that downward if needed, then I can kind of take that back and reverse engineer. So, okay, the anesthesiologist is going to do this much volume of the block. Surgeon, you only have 10 cc's of lido 1% left to give that we're going to agree that we feel comfortable with, for example. And if you need more volume or more spread, you can dilute that with normal saline, but do not give more than 10 cc's of lido 1%. You know, so it can kind of be an exercise in math and also in kind of thinking in the gray and kind of weighing these different risk factors collaboratively. But that's kind of the framework and the assessment that is ideal, I think, on the front end to help prevent last, hopefully. And the doses that we have in table 7 are our best interpretation of those maximums that we could offer with all those caveats, which also include, I failed to mention, if the drug is given with or without epinephrine or other concomitant medications with that injection, there's really just a multitude of factors that affect the safety profile of these drugs. So that's a place to start in a very simplified, as succinct way as I could say, I guess.
So you kind of talking about the local anesthetics themselves and things to consider, but are there maybe patient specific factors that might increase your risk for that? Where, like you said, you know, they mentioned by 10 to 20% for those at increased risk, who might you define as at increased risk for developing last?
Sure. So some of the evidence-based risk factors that have come out that the guidelines do a nice job summarizing as well. Include extremes of age. Low muscle mass is a big one, so malnourishment, frailty, cardiac disease, and hepatic disease are big ones, but also any patient that ends up being hypoxic or acidotic also falls in there. There's probably a dozen risk factors that are in the patient-related category that we could offer, some of them more common than others. In addition to the medication-related risk factors and the administration-related risk factors. So it really is a lot to think about.
So moving from kind of like risk factors and dose, Rachel, one of the questions that I've always had is when you think of last, one of the big symptoms is neurotoxicity. So when someone's in the OR, how is that neurotoxicity, or how are some of these adverse side effects going to show themselves? Obviously, if their heart stops, that's an easy one to see the adverse effect there. But what other signs and symptoms might we see, and are they going to look a little different in this, in the OR patient kind of under anesthesia?
Yeah, that's a great question, Nick. You know, I think, you know, as as you mentioned, the initial signs of LAS, which most people feel are the initial signs, commonly present themselves as that CNS type of changes. So those perioral numbness, the lethargy, dizziness, agitation, confusion, and then ultimately progressing to seizures. But really, what does that look like in the intraoperative space, where we have general anesthesia, deep sedation, things like that, that really, they really obscure those signs and symptoms. So honestly, in those particular cases, I think a lot of the times the first sign and symptom that we would actually notice in the OR is that progression to the severe hemodynamic instability of our patient. We've also had some patients upon emergence, that they actually are seizing. So that's kind of a sign that perhaps it could be local anesthetic toxicity in some of those patients at emergence. But for the most part, a lot of those signs of the CNS toxicity are masked. We do within the perioperative space here, it's also recommended by, or at least almost recommended by ISNP in their most recent 2022 guidelines. We had a conversation about putting it in there, mandating it, but it's recommended that you monitor patients usually for at least 30 minutes after any type of block or any injection from the peripheral regional standpoint of things, just so that way you can monitor the patients for any of those signs and symptoms of the neurotoxicity prior to actually placing the patient under general anesthesia. But for the most part, it certainly could be obscured in that setting.
So treatment of that local anesthetic systemic toxicity is focused on the use of lipids, right? Intralipid therapy. So, Sarah, what should we know about the use of IV lipids when treating LAS? What are some things for us to consider and make sure we rules or things that are followed when doing this?
Sure. I mean, firstly, we don't know nearly as much as we would like to know. Again, no randomized controlled trial, no high quality data to be had here. So ASRO's done a good job in that most recent 2020 checklist I mentioned of really trying to simplify this and expedite therapy of intralipid in last emergencies so that we're not probably unnecessarily overthinking this. So I only practice in adults, so these statements only apply to adults. I do not have pediatric experience to speak to, but pretty much any adult, the initial dose of intralipid is going to be 100 mL. So it's recommended that we have the 20% lipid emulsion bag stocked everywhere that local anesthesia is done. We can talk more about the preparation if we want, but if you're in this situation, you really just need to remember, get to the bedside with the bag of intralipid and get it there quick. You're going to grab the biggest syringe you can and draw out, or that's 50 cc's, and then pass that to the anesthesiologist while you draw out the other 50 cc's and pass that. Certainly, if you have a very small adult patient, you might adjust that downward. 1.5 milligrams per kilo is technically the dose for adults who are under 70 kilos. But even that's not going to get you a huge dose adjustment. And all of these doses are approximate. They all have approximate designations in the guidelines for this reason. So again, just in your head, if nothing else, if you are getting called to the bedside for a suspected last emergency, grab the 20% intralipid bag, draw out the biggest syringes you can, and pass them to the anesthesia provider to push over 2 to 3 minutes. Then you can spike the rest of that bag and give it another 250 cc's or so over the following 15 to 20 minutes is kind of the next step in the guidelines while you're also providing concurrent supportive care. And if the patient remains unstable or if they improve and then decompensate again, you can bolus them again. It's honestly, it has a relatively, apparently pretty good safety profile in this setting. It's really just about getting this to the patient as efficiently as possible. I also highly recommend this as an opportunity to just make a kit. We have a last kit that we keep in OR Pharmacy Satellite, and it has the dosing card, that colorful kind of simplified flowchart from ASRO's 2020 checklist. It has the bag of intralipid. It has the big syringes that we need, the tubing that we need. So just everything that you're going to need, which isn't a lot, but just having it in one place with the dosing guide that you can just run in there and have everything you need, and a point of care guide is something I strongly recommend that, that pharmacists employ.
So especially for our some of our maybe smaller institutions, right, that maybe they only have one or two bags of intralipids, right? So what do we do? What advice can we give if they run out of lipids? I mean, obviously the next step would be then to try to move them, right, to another facility that may have them or whatnot. But what do we try to do in the interim? Is there anything we can do?
Yeah, that's a sticky situation. Run down to anybody who's making TPNs and take their lipids. Basically, it comes down to other supportive measures at that point. So are they seizing? Is the neurotoxicity predominant? Benzos are going to be your preferred therapy. You're probably unlikely going to run out of benzos. So keep those coming. Things you don't want to reach for, you don't want to think that propofol is in any way a substitute for the lipid emulsion in this situation. It's highly recommended to avoid it, or if you need to give it from a refractory seizure control perspective, to give very low doses. Even though propofol is also in a lipid emulsion, obviously the negative inotropic and other cardiovascular depressive effects are going to be very dangerous in the poisoned heart in a last situation. So even though it's the same milky looking substance, we don't want to reach for that. Benzo is recommended for the seizures. If arrhythmias, hypotension, the cardiovascular effects predominate or are there in addition, being aware that there are recommendations that kind of diverge from standard ACLS in this situation in light of kind of the pathophysiology and toxicology of the poisoned heart in a last emergency. So if you're getting to a situation where you're going to need epinephrine, which hopefully you can give this prior to, you know, complete arrest, but we're really thinking about micro anesthesia push doses of epinephrine, which is something that a lot of pharmacists may not be super familiar with. But they literally recommend giving no more than 1 microgram per kilo of epinephrine. So a lot of anesthesia providers are used to working with either a 10 microgram per ml or 6 ml push dose concentration of epinephrine in the OR. So you want to make sure that we're thinking about that type of a concentration and dilution, not the code cart epi, if we can avoid it, and giving these very small incremental doses so that we don't dig ourselves into a bigger hole from a supply-demand mismatch. We want to be very careful to avoid, obviously, beta blockers, calcium channel blockers. Vasopressin is also advised to avoid in the situation, and just continue otherwise generally supportive measures as best we can.
And your emphasis on the different doses and different formulations, right? I want to bring back what Garang had said about when you go into the OR, sometimes you're going and just looking at, okay, how was this made? How was this labeled? And making sure, right, that we're giving the right doses. So something I wanted to bring back there. Rachel, what did we miss in terms of clinical pearls or other things to consider? Maybe a couple take-home points, big picture, when we're thinking of last either recognition or treatment.
Yeah, for me, I think, you know, as a perioperative clinical pharmacist, just making sure your space is prepared for one of these events. I think you can't educate and train enough and remind people, where do we go for our lipids? Where do we go for the checklist? Anytime you have these rare events, you need to set people up for success. So making sure that they have a nice, succinct, concise checklist, which ASRAS, as Sarah mentioned, has a great checklist that's out there. With better and more streamlined dosing recommendations, all those recommendations of that she just mentioned about the dosing of the benzos and the epi, all on that checklist. And then also think about the things that could catch people up. So we recently had an event to where I think our intralipids are called fat emulsion in the Pyxis. So everyone's thinking intralipid and lipids and couldn't find it. And it's just little things like that that can really trip up the bedside clinicians as they're trying to respond to one of these events. So anytime you have events, debrief those events, figure out, did our systems work the way we intended them to? What can we improve upon the next time that we have one of these events in our area?
Rachel, I'll say that we had that exact same incident at our institution where fat emulsion is how lipids are kept in the Pyxis. and we had trouble that the nurses and some of the providers were having a hard time locating it. We changed the labeling of it in the pictures after that event.
Yeah, so that's our solution as well.
Fantastic considerations with a disease state LAST that is becoming more and more common. So let's transition to discuss one of the most famous high-risk, low-utilization medications in all the hospital, dantrolene. Thinking about dantrolene, our treatment for malignant hyperthermia, and when we're thinking of high-risk, low-utilization meds, right? Malignant hyperthermia is such a rare phenomenon, right? Some may have never seen it in their practice, right? But it's one of those you always got to be stay prepared because when it happens, right, it's a drop what you're doing emergency, right? So, Eric, what kind of goes into like the preparation and readiness with dantrolene, thinking specifically in that malignant hyperthermia treatment?
Yeah, you know, Nick, you're absolutely correct that MH really is a rare event. And with the improvements and higher focus on screening patients before surgery, you know, we've seen over the last 10 to 15 years, the incidence of reported MH drop even further. So it is becoming almost once in a career, twice in a career type of event. However, when you get that level of infrequency, it certainly creates the opportunities for potential unfamiliarity and loss in terms of best practices from both providers, pharmacists, and an enterprise. And we also know from studies that, you know, if there is a delayed treatment for MH, there is a increased worsening or a worsening in terms of outcomes for the patient. So in many ways, preparation and time is of the essence. From a pharmacy standpoint, you know, I think that at a bare minimum, pharmacists can be prepared for these events by being prepared to retrieve the dantrolene as well as provide dosing, reconstitution, and administration guidance for providers in that space. You know, as pharmacists, though, we really take planning and preparation to a further level. And so going beyond that basic drug supply or medication procurement step, I think is a great opportunity for pharmacists to really elevate the practice, both of providers and for the institution. So becoming involved in how your institution prepares for a malignant hyperthermia event. Do they do frequent drills and simulations? And if so, making sure that a pharmacist is present both for those simulations, but then also in the real life thing. So we're accustomed to being relied upon for being in that space. A lot of times, pharmacists can also play a significant role in building or crafting these malignant hyperthermia or MH carts. This is something that you'll see a lot of institutions. It's sort of a consolidated collection of many of the therapies that are going to go into that treatment response. And this might take, from a pharmacy standpoint, advocating to pharmacy and therapeutics committees, discussing various drug formulations, and understanding quantities that need to be available for providers for the treatment of an MH type of scenario. And then going beyond that, you know, I think it's significant value for pharmacists to educate other pharmacy providers in that space. So at our institution, our pharmacy residents are part of the MH response team. If they were to be called to an MH event, we provide them training, orientation, and walk them through the steps of both reconstituting dantrolene, as well as how to appropriately navigate the perioperative space. And, you know, from a planning and preparation standpoint, I think Rachel hit it absolutely correctly. You really can't over drill or over prepare for these type of events, because there's a good chance that last time your institution experienced MH, all those providers have moved on, retired, or aren't present. So for a lot of individuals, it will be their first time. And so as a pharmacist, we really have the opportunity to know the ins and outs of both the medication, but as well as the treatment pathways for that suspected MH case.
You mentioned sometimes the biggest challenge is just knowing where the cart is and where to go get it, right? Sometimes, so the training piece of, because it's very rarely is this going to happen Wednesday at noon, right? It's going to happen when you're, when you have the least amount of people, right? And when chaos can happen. So, Gurung, let's go into a little bit about our dantrolene dosing and kind of clinical pearls as it relates to like in the administration and how we give it in this scenario.
Yeah, the dosing is fairly, there's actually recommendations for preoperative kind of management, even days before the surgery, depending on the protocol. But the intraoperative one, generally the loading dose that's given over that first period of, you know, 10 minutes or so is about 2.5 milligram per kilogram. And then thereafter, 1 milligram per kilogram. Your standard vials, if you're at, you know, for the listeners, if you're in an institution where you have, you know, the emulsion, you know, really fancy Rhinodex, I'm jealous.
Very jealous.
But for many, yeah, for many of the hospitals, they're good old 20 milligram vials that have to be reconstituted one at a time with sterile water. So, you know, it's actually pretty interesting. I always teach it as if you remember the first time you, well, at least for me, at that time, amiodarone was in ampules. And you had to bust open the ampule, hope you didn't, you know, cut your thumb or your finger, get the filter needle, draw it up. But I remember doing it the first couple of times, and it was just foam and soap and stuff everywhere. And it was during a code, and it was a little embarrassing. And I hadn't had an opportunity to draw it up as a resident because we didn't have, we had the vials as a resident. But at the hospital, we had these ampules. And when we finally went to vials, I'm like, okay, I remember the first few times this happened. It's a little bit similar with dantrolene after it gets reconstituted. There's some mannitol in there, but it's, I think, a great opportunity if you have an experiential educate, whether it's a resident or a pharmacy student. Actually, and if you don't, a pharmacy technician, to be honest, take them with you because you're going to need all the help you can get. And you really just line up the vials because you're going to need at least 10 to 15 of those. And you start diluting them one at a time and drawing them up as quick as you can. So the key is fast, but be patient. I kind of use it as with amiodarone. Don't try to do too much too quick because either the plunger will get messed, something will get messed up. You got foam coming out of the tip of the syringe. It's kind of a mess all over the place. But after you get that piece accomplished, then it's really drawing up your doses and your vials kind of one at a time. And I think Sarah hit on it earlier. After you get, what we usually typically do is you get 50 or so milligrams or, you know, you get a certain dose and then all of a sudden, typically I'll use 60 or, you know, 120, you know, after I get about 3 or 4 vials or 80, you'll hand over that dose. And then you go ahead and start drawing up more until you hit kind of that 2.5 milligram approximately. Per kilo dose, and then you'll have to obviously see if you get a response, and if you do, then obviously you're going to give more. I think recognition is a really big thing. You know, I think everybody kind of mentioned it. It's I think in my career maybe 4 or 5 times over 20 years, so not very often. But it's recognition. So then, you know, as soon as you start hearing things when you go in the room, like the theme everybody's hearing, it's like thinking of all the things that we just kind of went through and mentioned. But yeah, that's how I would summarize it.
Yeah, until we were preparing for this talk, I didn't even know that there were vials other than the 20 milligrams. So when I heard that, I got instantly jealous of those institutions. So Gurung did a really good job of painting the picture of what it's like. Eric, walk us through, I'm curious, for those who have never made it, right, from you get the call or you get the page to kind of the end, give us a little bit of a play-by-play of what it's like acutely preparing dantrolene. Because like Gurung mentioned, and I experienced this the first time too, it's the first time you do it, I wouldn't say it was pretty or it was my best work as a bedside pharmacist.
Yeah, it really is night and day, depending on what type of formulation of dantrolene you have. Our institution uses actually, or we have historically used both Ryanodex, which is 250 milligrams per 5 mLs, and then the Revanto or Dantrum, which is 20 milligrams per 60 mLs. And just sort of painting a picture there, if you're looking at a 90 kilogram individual, that 2.5 mg per kg dose is going to be 225 milligrams of Dantrum. So if you have Ryanodex, that's one vial, and 5 cc's of sterile water goes into it. It goes into solution extremely quickly, beautiful orange color, ready to hand it over, save the day. If you have Dantrum or Revanto, your day got a little bit longer. That 225 milligrams, it's going to take you 12 vials to get that with the 20 milligrams per 60 cc's vial formulation. Furthermore, that's almost 750 milliliters of volume that you're reconstituting of sterile water. So to say that you need one individual is probably pretty ambitious. When we've had it in the past, there are a line of individuals of nurses reconstituting all those vials. And as Grong mentioned, that's just for the first dose. You're obviously hoping for changes in heart rate, end tidal CO2, seeing dissipation of the classic signs of MH, but understanding that you are going to be giving subsequent doses if you're not seeing resolution of those symptoms. And so needing to stock addition or needing to acquire additional options. MHOS, which is a national resource hotline that is dedicated to the treatment of malignant hyperthermia, it's a great resource and similar to what Sarah and Rachel were talking about in terms of LAST. They very succinctly provide a reference document at their website in terms of what you should have both in your MH cart as well as if you are experiencing a MH crisis at this time, click here, and they would additionally provide guidance for steps of how to approach that that crisis. In terms of what they recommend from a basic stocking of your MH cart, they recommend either 3 vials of Ryanodex or 36 vials of Revanto in order to be able to effectively treat that MH crisis. So definitely a large footprint, and that goes along the lines in terms of formulary advocates by the clinical pharmacist for how your institution decides to approach MH as a response. So very big difference between those two different formulations. We're fortunate now that we've recently converted all over to Ryanodex. So I hate to say you're looking forward to an MH crisis, but I feel much more well-equipped to address one if one does arise.
And that's the importance of the kit is when you're reconstituting these, you're not going to have enough sterile water vials or big 50 to 60 cc syringes around. Your life is going to be terrible if you're trying to do this with 10 cc syringes. So preparation is key for all that. And you're exactly right. When you bring the cart around, everyone's heard about it. So it's like everyone kind of goes around if there are people. So you mentioned nurses want to help, right? It's an all hands on deck scenario. So I thought that was a great play-by-play. Your day just got a little longer. That's the nicest way you could put it. You're absolutely right. We opened part one with a roundtable discussion, and part two will close with one. So all four panelists joined me to give some reflections of the past and hopes for the future within perioperative clinical pharmacy. We'll kind of do the reverse alphabetical by first name. Gosh, that's a tongue twister. But kind of starting with Sarah, what's a piece of advice you wish someone would have told you as you started your career in the perioperative space, kind of knowing that this is probably one of the areas that growth will be occurring as we look to kind of create positions in hospitals, institutions, et cetera?
Yes, I appreciate this question, Nick. So if I was guiding somebody who was just getting started in the space today, I would first offer some things that just straight up didn't exist at the time that I was getting started. And so knowing your resources and knowing your people, your professional home, And what I would offer on that front is the ACCP Perioperative Care PRN, or Practice and Research Network, of whom all of our group today has been very active in, and our opinion paper on perioperative clinical pharmacy practice. We really made this as a guidance document to help provide that map and that outline of what we can do in this space, how to demonstrate value, get resources, what workflows can look like, what priorities and training looks like, precepting. We really cover all that and really try to, you know, support that, provide that guide to people who are just starting out. When it comes to me personally, if I could go back, you know, to 2011, 2012, when I was first getting involved in the space, and certainly in 2013 when we were starting our first position, it would have been to spend more time at the desk, spend more time hanging out at the main OR front desk, connecting with people, listening, really connecting with the entire team to help build that trust. I think as pharmacists, we're really good at, you know, bringing the evidence, bringing the data, you know, making evidence-based interventions. And, you know, if you're ED-minded like I was at the time, maybe you're good at, you know, helping expedite medications and, you know, helping the team make good decisions in high-risk situations. And that's all great, but all that knowledge and skills get rendered useless when people just don't know or trust you. And I have a great story I wanted to end on that front that happened pretty recently, actually. So I got dispatched into an OR by the nurse anesthetist had called me. And this was, you know, we're probably 2 years into a great initiative where we've been working on increasing use of cefazolin and penicillin allergic patients based on, you know, current evidence and the value of delabeling penicillin allergies and so on that as pharmacists we all know and love. So this patient had been ordered cefazolin. They had a penicillin allergy. We had evaluated it. The nursing, you know, staff prepared it. The anesthesiology provider was about to give it. But the surgeon was like, wait, they're allergic to penicillins. And the nurse anesthetist was like, well, that's, you know, the risk is very low. And, you know, pharmacy recommends this. And the surgeon was like, put me on the phone with them. And so the nurse anesthetist, you know, calls me and she's like, Sarah, you know, Dr. Jones is really uncomfortable with it. And she kind of points both Sarah at the surgeon. And the surgeon goes, so what are the odds that my patient dies of anaphylaxis on the table today? And I'm like, the cross reactivity is way less than 1%, sir, and it is the best drug at preventing infection in your patient. I do recommend it, and I have the evidence and our institutional protocols to back that up if you'd like to discuss further. And he's like, And who is this again? And I was like, this is Sarah with pharmacy. And he's like, oh, Sarah, I know you. I trust you. Okay, let's do it. So, I mean, it just goes to show you that you can have the right answer, but the right answer isn't going to ultimately be the right answer if you don't have a relationship to stand upon sometimes first, especially in a, you know, potentially a high risk or fast paced emergency situation. So never underestimate the value of building those relationships alongside your clinical interventions and expertise.
What a great plug for the PRNs. Love the PRN, Critical Care PRN sponsors this. And Sarah, I just got to go on record. That was a great surgeon voice. That was a great impression. If you're looking for a second career, I think you got it. Really, really great advice. I love that story. Rachel, what about you?
Yeah, great story, Sarah. And I actually will also plug the PRN, the perioperative PRN, because if I were to go back and wish I would have done something differently, had it been available, would then find a perioperative pharmacist mentor. So I feel like we're still very new within the space, but at the same time, there's a lot more perioperative pharmacist mentors out there that are able to to be that mentor and that guide to what would we have done differently, you know, building relationships. Absolutely, absolutely agree with Sarah. Those relationships and spending time in the space, understanding because the workflow in the space works completely different than the inpatient setting. And you have to understand that to be the best advocate for the people who you are servicing and supporting within the perioperative space. So I think finding a mentor is absolutely one of my one of the pieces of advice that I would provide. And then also I'm a little bit jealous of Sarah as well, as when the workload became so great for me, I just buckled down and worked harder. And I didn't really get the guidance to to expand. I mean, in a way, you know, it was kind of out there, but how to get the FTEs, as Gurung even mentioned at the very beginning, sometimes that's difficult to get the FTEs into petition that this is needed in this space. So I just buckled down and tried to work harder, tried to feel like, oh, I need to be more efficient. I need to be more resilient. Always like putting it off on myself is why I was struggling in this space. But really, there's so much opportunity to address and to improve and to help that the workload is so great. So really, I think if I could go back to, I would expand and work on expanding my team a lot sooner than what I have.
Mentorship, such great advice, right? Learning from other people's challenges or things that they had to overcome, mistakes they made or things would have done differently. I think that's not only in this space, just in general. I think that's great advice. Gurung, what about your perspective?
Yeah, just to build on what Sarah and Rachel went through, I think kind of turning the clock back quite a bit, it would have been first, learn everyone's role before you try to do anything. Go spend a day with a pre-op nurse. Go spend a day with a PACU nurse. Go spend a day with the nurse in the OR. Go spend a day with the anesthesiologist. Go spend a day with the surgical resident. And kind of learn what they do. And I think they honed in on it. They both did. And I know Eric has mentioned this as well. Build a relationship. Build trust. You're going to need their help to do anything. So before you do anything or think about doing anything, get to know who you're working with. And I wish I would have done that more earlier. Align what you want to do with what they're working on. Surprise, surprise, because they're going to support it. They're more likely to going to support whatever you want to do, whether it's a formulary, you're attacking something in the formulary in terms of cost, or something has to do with quality, or all the above. Be humble. You don't think you know as much as you might think you know. You really don't. And so that kind of transitions into listen. Just listen as much as you can. Ask questions. It's probably one of the most underrated tools on that leadership pathway or road. And listen as much as you can. You'll learn a lot more. And, you know, obviously you're going to research things and look into things and guidelines, but just listen.
I love that. I heard be humble, and it's kind of like be humble or you will be humbled in that scenario. Right. So I think that's really good advice. And Eric, kind of close us out with, if you know, advice that you wish someone would have told you as you started, kind of your role in the perioperative space.
Yeah, I definitely echo everything that my colleagues have said, but perhaps provide a little bit more harder edge of advice or recommendation. And that is, if you are in that space and you see value and you're hearing these things that we're doing and you see that your institution would benefit from that, don't let people tell you that you as a pharmacist don't belong in that space, or clinical pharmacy doesn't have a role in that area. I can't tell you how many times in my early career I had to pep talk myself to say, what you found here is real. What you're doing has value. It doesn't matter that, you know, you are not getting the positive feedback from department heads that perhaps you would in another space. There is definitely value, and this is where clinical pharmacy, I think, can provide tremendous benefit.
What great advice. I think kind of the perfect way to end this would be, now, how do each of you see the role of perioperative pharmacy services kind of changing in kind of this 5 to 10 years? Because, you know, from, you know, what I'm gathering from a lot of you, right, is that it's already changed in 5 to 10 years from when a lot of you have been practiced. So what do you all envision kind of seeing where the future of this is? So Eric, let's have you bat lead off for this final question here.
Thanks so much. Yeah, I think I'm very interested to hear what my colleagues have to say. We specifically didn't share with each other about this, but you know, I think that the healthcare's alignment with value-based care
And some of the metrics that Garong talked about, I think that there is going to be a very easy and obvious role for perioperative pharmacists for process improvement and decreasing adverse surgical outcomes. That I think one arm of clinical pharmacy in that space will be very much ingrained with all the other healthcare leadership individuals that are focused so intently on making sure that patients have good outcomes and that the hospital delivers to its full potential.
Garong, what about your perspective?
Yeah, in addition, I think to the and like a number of quality and safety metrics, which are on report cards and things that are public knowledge. You know, one of the other things that I think will really kind of change is the scope. So I call it being comfortable with things that are uncomfortable. So get comfortable with them. So one of those for me was pediatrics. Expand what you're doing and what you're working on. It'll make you more valuable. It's going to make our group more valuable. It's not easy, but it wasn't intended to be easy, but it's simple. But it's not easy. And the other piece of it is, and I know this is kind of a roller coaster right now with experiential education around the country, whether it's residency programs, pharmacy colleges, even retention of, you know, faculty and pharmacists on site. And one of the things I, you know, wanted to mention is that look for opportunity. And I think what we can do is look for opportunity within your teams of people looking for more. I think the periop area is unique in there is so much, like everybody mentioned. So maybe somebody really has a niche in transitions of care. Well, you can find something for them. Maybe they're on the medicine side or the ICU side, but they don't work immediately in the periop space, for example. Try to find opportunity within the perioperative space for those that aren't in it directly. I think that really helps with support, but it really helps expand the knowledge base.
Rachel, what about you?
So I think in 5 to 10 years, I'm really hoping that we can expand the perioperative landscape to where there will be more pharmacists within and supporting the entire surgical continuum. So there's a lot of healthcare institutions that have preoperative assessment clinics. So we're really, as we're trying to improve the quality of our patients' outcomes, we're really realizing that pre-optimization plays a huge role in how the patients actually respond throughout their surgical recovery. And so I think, you know, from that standpoint, of there's so many things that a pharmacist has the skill sets to do in the optimization realm of care. So I really foresee integrating a pharmacist in that space. We can also, I think, solve so many issues as it relates to the medication, essentially history collection and pretty much reconciliation through all the transitions of care throughout the phases and at discharge, teaching on multimodal analgesia. There's just so much opportunity that I think a pharmacist really has the most appropriate skill set to actually improve our patient care. So I'm excited that I'm hopeful that there's going to be opportunity for us to show our value in those 5 to 10 years as it relates to improving the quality of our patient outcomes.
So, Sarah, close us out in where you think the role of perioperative pharmacy services could be changing in that 5 to 10 year kind of future timeframe.
Overall, I think that perioperative clinical pharmacy is where ED clinical pharmacy was 10 years ago. And I think it's going to follow the same trajectory. I think it's going to continue to explode. We're going to continue to recognize all these great roles across this entire continuum of as my colleagues have highlighted. And I think along with that, I'm really hoping that, you know, as a profession, we can improve our training in this front. I'm hopeful that there will be more regular rotations for APPEs, for PGY1 pharmacy residents, that eventually we will have a PGY2 in perioperative clinical pharmacy, a board certification in periop, because it's such an expansive area that's tangential to many of our existing trainings and board certifications, but nothing totally captures it right now. And so I really think where this burgeoning specialty within our profession that's going to continue to grow. And I'm hoping to see our learners and our training expand in this area to support that growth. So really appreciate you again giving us this platform to have this conversation, Nick. It's been really awesome to come together and describe our different perspectives and talk with you about this exciting area. So thanks again for having us.
No, thank you, Sarah, Eric, Rachel, and Gurong. We've all learned a lot from both your knowledge bases and experience. Very, very grateful. So, no, thank you. Thank you all so much. Be sure to listen to both parts of this awesome series on perioperative emergencies and let the guests and I know what you thought. You can find me on Twitter or Instagram at PharmacyToDose, TO2Dose, or via email, PharmacyToDose@gmail.com. A reference list with the articles we discussed today and more, including the nomination form for the 2023 awards, that is in the podcast episode description, as well as the website, PharmacyToDose.com. And until next time, I'm Nick Peters, and this is Pharmacy to Dose, the Critical Care Podcast. QXMD builds mobile solutions that drive evidence-based care in clinical practice. So check out Read for easy access to research personalized for you, Calculate for over 500 easy-to-use decision support tools, and Learn to earn CME online in minutes per day. Try them today at qxmd.com/apps. Again, that is qxmd.com/apps. The Critical Care PRN is dedicated to fostering the role of critical care pharmacists as essential members of the multidisciplinary patient care team. The Critical Care PRN's goal is to optimize drug therapy outcomes by promoting excellence and innovation in clinical pharmacy practice, research, and education. For more information, including how to become a member, go to critprn.accp.com. Again, that website is critprn.accp.com.